WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Women comprise more than half of the Iraqi population, but in the new interim Iraqi government, which will take the reins of sovereignty from the U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority next week, women will fill only six of the 33 ministerial positions. Compared to other Muslim countries in the Middle East, that's a big achievement, and overall, Iraqi women have played a relatively active role in their society and as breadwinners in their families, as community leaders, educators, doctors, and engineers. But that doesn't necessarily mean women are sufficiently represented in Iraq. Since the overthrow of Saddam, the U.S. has promoted the advancement of women in many ways, but whether the voice of Iraqi women is being heard or stifled is up for debate. Tonight on Point, the voice of Iraq's women. With the handover to Iraqi sovereignty a week away, are you hoping that women will play a significant role in the new Iraq? Do you measure the success of the new Iraqi government by the country's treatment of women, by the representation of women? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We turn first to Baghdad itself, where the Iraq interim government is preparing for the U.S. handover of sovereignty a week from now. I spoke earlier to Nasreen Barawi, Iraq's Minister of Municipalities and Public Works. She's one of six female ministers in the new interim government and was one of three women on the now-dissolved Iraq Governing Council. I asked her to describe the challenges she's faced in rising to her position.
The ministerial position for me is not new. I was a minister at the regional level for 4 years before coming down to Baghdad and joining the government that was appointed by the Iraqi Governing Council. I was a minister at the Kurdistan Regional Government. So, in a way, the challenge of being a woman minister in Iraq today is not generated of being a woman as much as it is a challenge because of what we have to do and what we have to recover and what we have to regroup from the institution and improve life and stabilize things and create jobs. So it's what we need to do that is challenging and managing the expectation of the public.
But have you faced prejudice as a woman in being a government minister?
I haven't, and maybe the new women ministers may, but I personally, being an engineer, have always worked in men worlds and have always managed sites and had field trips and was always had to do work with men and manage expectation and plan with men and talk to councils that are all headed by men. So in a way, my whole professional life has trained me for this position. And you know, you start establishing good relationship with your subordinate by being competent, by being good leader, good manager, compassionate leader too, and give them the understanding and provide them the support. So it's really how you come across as professional women. And the more professional you are, the less women they see you.
But, I mean, is it your opinion that there are more women out there in Iraq with the right sort of qualifications, with the right amount of self-confidence, that could be doing the kind of job that you are doing now, that there could be more women ministers in that government?
Yes, I have a great faith on Iraqi women, and the quality of Iraqi women goes way back decades. Women in Iraq 30, 40 years were artists, were painters, were poets. They were very progressive in the society. They did not hold ministerial jobs just because of the government did not allow them, but they feel. They were always moving with the pulse of the people. They have opinions. They have things to say. And it was now, after the liberation of Iraq and after the overthrow of the Saddam regime, it was the chance, the golden chance for women to be free, to come out of their nest and aspire to be part of the political process. And they worked hard. And today in the interim government, we have six women ministers. They manage different fields, environment, social affairs, agriculture, migrant and displacement, and women affairs. So different sectors are now headed by women, very qualified women, and I have great faith that they will succeed, just like any other man having the same quality will succeed.
But nonetheless, despite the fact that women make up 60% of the Iraqi population, they're represented in government at levels of less than 20%.
But you have to think about what we had before. Under Saddam, we had zero women representation for 34 years. The only two times that Iraq had women ministers, and it was only one, was one time in 1958, and another time in 1968, both, I think, for a few months. And since then, since 68, there was no women ministers in any of the Iraqi government cabinets. But today, of course, after liberation, there was the first cabinet, and I was the only one out of 25. And today, in the interim government, we have 6 out of 33. So in a way, it's a movement toward the right direction. It's not enough for women, but if you think of the trend, it's setting the right stage for more woman participation. That doesn't mean it's going to happen by itself. Women have to continue to struggle to assert their aspiration and to seek guarantees, constitutional guarantees, legal guarantees, and work more on women empowerment. The gains that are happening so far on women issue, it's still influenced by external support, whether it's the Coalition Provisional Authority or the UN, the Akhdar Ibrahimi, you know, influence on the choice of the government, the interim government. Whether we will continue to move in that trend after election, that's something I, as a woman, don't feel confident since the transitional administrative law was not recognized by the Security Council resolution, which leaves women gain that were in that TAL, the transitional administrative law, in question. And as a woman, I don't feel very assured about my future.
It doesn't say, though, much for the influence of the international community. If they had such a role in putting together this interim government, the best they could manage was 6 women in a 33-member government.
Well, you have to also understand the dynamic that went along this creation. It wasn't only the UN and the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority. It was the Iraqi Governing Council. It was talking to the different communities. Al-Akhdar Ibrahimi was talking to many people, trying to get people's feeling and aspiration. And you have to balance with the different point of views that exist in Iraq society. There is this trend, the conservative trend, that is against women empowerment, against the women having any role. And then you have the supportive trend, but still conservative. They think 20-25 is enough. And then you have women aspiration, which seeked and wanted 40% representation. So as a balance and as a first time in not only Iraq history, but in the Middle East, in the whole region, it's the first time for this much of women to take. So I think it's a great time for women in Iraq, and I think it's great movement. We just need to sustain those gains by supporting it constitutionally, so we maintain those gains and empower women and train more women and help the current women in office to succeed, although the challenges are big on men and women ministers in Iraq today. But just like everywhere else, people always criticize women and look at them as they need to be perfect more than a man. But it's a challenging time. There will be a lot of need for external support, not only in terms of keeping the pressure for Iraq to become a democracy, but also to support Iraq reconstruction and Iraq society and country reorientation from dictatorship to democracy.
That was Nasreen Barawi, Iraq's Minister of Municipalities and Public Works. Her commentary entitled An Iraqi Minority Report appeared in today's Wall Street Journal. She spoke to me earlier from Baghdad. And joining me now in the studio is Swanee Hunt, founder of the non-profit organization Women Waging Peace, which advocates the full participation of women peace processes around the world. She's a lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and a former U.S. ambassador. Her article, Iraq's Excluded Women, appears in the July-August issue of Foreign Policy magazine. Welcome, Swanee Hunt.
Thank you.
We heard the personal experience there of Nasreen Barawi. She talked of moves in the right direction in Iraq, of the way in which perhaps women in Iraq had made more political strides than elsewhere in the Arab world. Do you share her faith, her confidence?
I know Nasreen Barawi. In fact, she was a student at the Kennedy School. And I am wild about her. She's extraordinarily competent. And she has worked very, very, very hard to get those six women into those ministerial positions. So this was a great victory for her. She did not talk about the fact that women, as you said, who are 60% of the population, hold zero of the top five positions, the presidency and the deputy president and prime minister and deputy prime minister. And that is a real problem. On the other hand, of course, 20% is better than what we have in the U.S. Congress, and I don't mean to take away from that. In fact, one of the things I love about Nasreen is that she is not a whiner. She is very much a roll-up-your-sleeves, get-it-done kind of
person. You say that she's worked very hard to get those six ministers into the new government. What was she up against?
Well, in part, she was up against the most conservative elements in Iraq. Sadly, in part, she was up against the United States and the coalition forces and the provisional authority. I can tell you that from my firsthand experience. I have done three trainings with Iraqi women leaders. The one was in Washington, one was in Cambridge here at Harvard, and one was in Amman, Jordan, and that one was in December. And at the end of that training, I flew into Baghdad and met with Ambassador Bremer. By the way, I met with the head of the Brits as well. And Bremer was adamant that he would not support any kind of even targeted proportion of representation.
And that was because he didn't want to antagonize religious communities?
Oh, hard to think that that's it. It's more that this administration has been so adamantly opposed to affirmative action at home, it would be the height of hypocrisy for them to insist on affirmative action abroad.
On it openly, but there are more subtle ways of going about this, aren't there?
Well, let me put it this way. When the potential leaders for Iraq were being gathered together by the Pentagon to plan for the post-shock and awe period. They had probably 150 or 200 leaders who were brought together, and of those, there were about three women. Now, that was with us deciding whom to invite into the room, us being the United States. Similarly, we appointed the Governing Council, 25, and we put three women on there. That Governing Council then chose a constitutional commission, zero women out of 25. You know, it was a travesty. It had to implode, in fact. You can't have no women represented on a constitutional group that is supposed to be there to protect women's rights.
So you're saying the seeds were sown some time ago?
Very early on, from the very beginning. There is a big gap between the words that have been used in the White House and what has happened on the ground.
And is there still that lack of political will in Washington to change the situation?
I would say so. There are some very well-intended people, some very good people, particularly at the State Department. I do believe that Colin Powell understands the importance of having women who are so good at bridging the divides in these situations, working across conflict lines. But he is up against a Pentagon that has almost no understanding of the power of women in these situations.
Swanee Hunt, do stay with us. We're talking tonight about women's status and political representation in Iraq. Our guest is Swanee Hunt, founder of the nonprofit organization Women Waging Peace. She's a lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and a former U.S. ambassador. Why is it so important to have women in leadership positions in Iraq? Could women's status slip back in Iraq when the world loses interest? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about women's status and political representation in Iraq. Our guest is Swanee Hunt, founder of the organization Women Waging Peace. She's a lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and a former U.S. ambassador. Should Iraqis themselves be able to dictate the percentage of women in government, or should the new government be given a nudge by the United States? Has the U.S. put enough emphasis on advancing women's status in Iraq? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Swanee Hunt, we've been speaking up until now about the lack of external pressures, if you like, in order to further female advancement in Iraq. Let's just dwell a little bit now on internal pressures. And I spoke earlier to Baghdad with Ala Talabani, co-founder of the organization Women for a Free Iraq and the Iraqi Women's High Council, which drafted policies on the role of women in Iraq's post-conflict reconstruction. She's a former vice president of the Kurdistan Women's Union. I asked her about cultural obstacles for women in Iraq.
We have problems with the culture. We met lots of women who they also don't believe that political is a women job as well. They think that political is something for men only. Women can't be a politician. Women can't be a minister. Unfortunately, there is women who have such belief. But there is a big number of men in our country. They don't believe that women can be in the same table with men. Women can be in the decision-making areas. Women can be in the government. Yes, they don't believe it, but this is our job. This is women movement's job. This is women human rights organizations, women's centers, which is everywhere now in Iran. This is our job. We have to do good work to change the mentality of Iraqi men and the Iraqi people in general. And they have to believe, and they have to strongly believe that political is our job as well. Men, we usually say, they're good at war, but we are very good in making peace and in negotiation as well.
Well, that was Ala Talabani, co-founder of the organization Women for a Free Iraq and the Iraqi Women's High Council, who spoke to me earlier from Baghdad. Swanee Hunt, I know that that last sentiment will certainly strike a note with you. Men are good at war, but we're very good, that women that is, at making peace and in negotiation as well.
Yes, women are very interesting. There's some clear differences between men and women in negotiations. I worked a lot in the Balkans, and that's where I worked with Bosnian Serbs, Bosnian Muslims, Croats, etc. And what I found repeatedly is that women were willing to say, yes, I am a Bosnian Serb, but I am a mother, and all mothers' tears are the same color, and those kinds of expressions. And they would reach out to the women from the other ethnic groups, and they'd say, we will band together using the mother identity or the women identity rather than the ethnic identity. And that's what you need in a situation like this.
But she was also saying, Ala Talabani, that we have good work to do to change the mentality of Iraqi men and Iraqi people in general.
You know, Julian, I heard that, and I was smiling to myself, remembering my old Congresswoman, Pat Schroeder. She's not old, but my former Congresswoman from Colorado, when she went to the U.S. Congress. And she was highly criticized for being in the Congress because she had children at home. And they said, how can you be in the Congress and be a good mother? And she said, because God gave me a brain and a uterus. And I was thinking about women in Northern Ireland, closer to your stomping grounds, who, when they won their seats as the Northern Irish Women's Coalition, they went in for the first time into the parliament, and some of the men started mooing as if they were cows, as if these women were cows. So this isn't about Iraqi culture. This is about men who have power being very hesitant.
So you're saying this has got nothing to do
with Islam? No, I'm not saying it has
patriarchal society.
Well, patriarchal societies, thank
right.
you. Thank you. Or shall we talk about the Judeo-Christian patriarchal society?
But that notion of a patriarchal society reinforced in Iraq and the rest of the Arab world by Islam.
Well, there are many, many different interpretations of Islam. And I am very sympathetic with what Ala was saying. She's a good friend of mine, about the challenges. But I'm telling you that we have in Boston many, many challenges in terms of getting women into politics here as well. And I think we do a disservice to simply put this in an Islam box and say that that's the problem.
Swanihan, let's take a call from Jamil. He's calling from Foxborough, Massachusetts. But is an Iraqi male. Jamil, what did you want to say?
Well, first of all, I'm a physician, and half of my classmates were women. Furthermore, I don't think it's an Islamic issue. I think this is misportrayed in the West. I think it is a patriarchal issue because of insecurity sometimes. And as the first minister mentioned, for a few months, the Baathists had a woman in their government. But I remember that very clearly, that she was given very limited powers, and because they gave a perfunctory only recognition of women. I think Iraqi women, both Arabs, Kurds, others as well, would cooperate between them because of their greater degree of resilience and smartness. I think they could bring about profound changes for Iraq, which would surpass, in my opinion, any place currently in the Arab world.
But at this present time, Jamil, do you feel that six women ministers in a 33-member government is enough?
Well, I appreciate what you're saying, but the trend is correct. It's not a matter of enough. It's in the right direction. And furthermore, even more important, the six ministers, if they have actually real say-so, that will be the litmus test for the future. It's not the numbers as much as the actual qualitative participation. And personally, I know and very much respect the new Prime Minister, Iyad Allawi, and I believe that he's not only a secular person, he's very open-minded, and I've discussed these things with him, and he's very open to encouraging these things. So I think the trends would be the same. As far as Ambassador Bremer representing the current administration, I'm not sure if that will hold much water in the near future.
Swanee Hunt, Jamil says we should be looking at the trend.
And he's right, absolutely, and we need to build on that strength. I think it's important for us quickly to come in and say we are not talking as if women are a monolithic group and all women are somehow peace-loving and all men are waging war, because that is absolutely not the truth. You will find plenty of women who are much more bellicose than a lot of men who are real leaders in the peace movements. On the other hand, Jamil, I would counter only one piece of what you said, which I thought was very eloquent, and that is that the numbers do matter. I was talking to a senator friend of mine from Sweden who described to me the difference between being in the Swedish parliament when there were about 8% women compared to when there were 48% women. And she said the same women in that 8%, they voted differently, they act differently, they led differently when they were in a larger number.
Jamil, your response to that?
No, I absolutely appreciate that. But all I'm saying is, and at this point in time, as a former Iraqi citizen, obviously I'm pained by the amount of, sort of insurgency and so forth. I think, first of all, security should be garnered. But I also believe that the numbers quantitatively and qualitatively will increase. Furthermore, let me go even further and say, as a Muslim, I personally believe the renaissance of Islam will be highly dependent on participation of women in the society, in an active participation. I know this may sound a little bit avant-garde for many of my colleagues and otherwise, but I certainly believe it's only when 50-55% of the population actually participate in a vocal sense, not that they're more perfect than men, it's just they're more resilient, I think.
Swanee Hunt, I think an interesting point there is the nature of Iraq society, and you as somebody who's had a lot of contact with Iraqi women, is it really a preoccupation of Iraqi women that they want this enhanced political status, or at the moment is the concern more for a secure, stable existence?
You know, I asked that question of a very small focus group, if you will. I was sitting on the floor on beautiful red rugs drinking tea with 10 women from a very poor neighborhood in Baghdad, and they were completely covered except for their faces. And we We talked about the empowerment training that they had been coming to this little house for a couple of months. These were women who were, as I say, very poor. They were Shia women. They had about a sixth grade education, fifth or sixth grade. And I asked them what percentage they thought of women should be in the new assembly. And one of them spoke up. She was a widow whose husband had been tortured and killed by Saddam. And she said, well, women absolutely should be 50%. And I said, well, 50%, you know, I mean, that's like more than any country in the whole world. And another woman across the room said, there's no reason it shouldn't be 50%. And I said, well, what about your husbands? What would they say? Thinking all of a sudden reality would set in. And a young woman spoke up and said, my husband is very proud of me that I'm learning to really have a voice, and he thinks it's great. So then I said, well, let's get real concrete. Who of you would be willing to run for office? City council, let's say. And all of a sudden, the conversation stopped, and they started talking among themselves. And finally, one of them put up her hand, and a second and a third out of the 10. And another woman spoke up, and she said, and we're going to work on their campaigns. So, you know, I'm told by Zainab Salbi, who is an Iraqi who's organizing these groups all over the country, that this is the general tenor.
Okay, let's take a call from Jean in Barrington, New Hampshire. I suspect a rather pithy comment. Jean, what do you want to say?
Yes, Julian, I think that you are picking on the progress that the Iraqis had made and are forgetting about the background of, say, the United States and England, where the percentage of women in high offices and department heads isn't even that high, and we've had a long tradition of democracy. I think you're a little bit off base.
Tony Hunt?
You're exactly right that this is the pot calling the kettle black, as my grandmother would say. The United States is certainly not the model here in terms of what we have succeeded in. We do not have a representative democracy, as far as I'm concerned, if you look at our parliament. On the other hand, the governing council that was established by the CPA, by the Provisional Authority, under U.S. control, was a dictatorship. We had complete control, and that's when we said three women out of 25 ministers. That's when we said, excuse me, three women out of 25 council members, one woman out of 25 ministers. And that was, to me, a travesty.
But what's the best way forward? Is it to talk percentages? Is it to talk getting to 25%, getting to 40%?
The women themselves, in multiple meetings all over the country, have asked for 40%. The Bush administration is allergic to quotas. I would say Americans in general are allergic to quotas. On the other hand, the question is, how much do you train and empower and encourage? And that's where, if you look at the dollars, you find that we're willing to spend $400 billion on military hard power to go in and try to force change. And in terms of what Joseph Nye calls soft power, the empowerment, the influencing, let's see, Bremer told me that he would put $20 million into working with women. 3 months later, when Colin Powell announced it, it was $10 million. So it lost 50% of its value in those 3 months. So this is pittance. And it really is a reflection of this notion that, you know, well, let's get the security settled, and then we can deal with the side issues like women's issues. In fact, we're not going to get the security settled until, as Jamil said earlier, until you bring women into the settling.
But again, I return to my earlier point. Is it enough simply to throw dollars at the problem, or have you got to tackle something much more fundamental, which is male attitudes?
Obviously, the male attitudes can be influenced very much by the women's attitudes, for one thing. As you help women with groups like the one I was describing to you in that neighborhood, And that costs some money. It means you fund nonprofit organizations in civil society who are doing that kind of empowerment training. Look, I'm a child of the 60s and 70s, and we had all kinds of consciousness-raising groups where we learned to speak our minds in the United States.
But do those kind of Western models really work in the Iraqi context?
They are working in the Iraqi context. They work all over the world. They work in Colombia and Cambodia and Congo.
Because I have the impression that Iraq, that women are becoming less and less visible.
That's not my impression. They certainly are less visible on our TV because, you know what? We're covering people who are out there angry in the streets. And isn't it notable that those aren't the women who are leading the angry demonstrations? I mean, maybe we ought to notice that. But in terms of what we ought to be doing, yes, we should be very much funding civil society movements, but we should also be supporting constitutional safeguards like Minister Barawi asked for.
And should we, as you say, presumably the United States and its coalition partner Britain, be doing this in consultation with Iraqis?
I wanted to tell you, Julian, earlier you set up a dichotomy. You said you were asking the listeners here to express their views. Should Iraqis decide on the role of women, or should they be nudged from the outside? I want to just reject that as the premise here. If you say, should Iraqis decide, who are you talking about? Which Iraqis? Are you talking about the men in Iraq, or are you talking about all of the people of Iraq? Right now, we aren't hearing from all of the people of Iraq.
I think I made that statement more in the broader context of the United States agenda in the Arab world, namely, should they be pushed from outside, or should Arab states be allowed to dictate their own progress towards more democratic states? And presumably that means more inclusive states as well.
Well, again, it depends what you mean when you say should Arab states. Do you mean should a dictatorship in Saudi Arabia or someplace like that? Or do you mean the real people? I mean, we have wonderful examples in Tunisia and several other Arab and Islamic states where women have very strong voices in their governance. So I am very much back with Jamil to say this is not an Islam issue per se. It is about how some groups use the Islamic faith, even as some groups use Christianity.
Swati Hunt, let's speak more. With the handover to Iraqi sovereignty a week away, are you hoping that women will play a significant role in the new Iraq? Do you measure the success of the new Iraqi government by the country's treatment of women? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest in the studio is Swati Hunt, founder of the organization Women Waging Peace and a lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about women's status and political representation in Iraq. Our guest is Swati Hunt, founder of the organization Women Waging Peace. Her article, Iraq's Excluded Women, appears in the July-August issue of Foreign Policy magazine. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Susan in Cambridge, Massachusetts, wants to join the conversation. She's on the line. Susan, what did you want to say?
Yes, Julian, I would like Ambassador Swati Hunt to comment on the religious law in Iraq that discriminate against women. I think the concern is that if the hardline religious leaders do take over, either after June 30th or during the elections, this could seriously jeopardize women's standing in Iraq. I'm just wondering if the ambassador could comment on that.
Thank you, Susan. There is a struggle for the soul of Islam, in a sense, in Iraq, but also throughout the Islamic world. And Jamil, you're my favorite. I keep going back to things that you said earlier when you talked about the need for a renaissance.
Of course, Jamil, our physician who grew up in Baghdad.
That's right. And there is there are many people who are calling for that renaissance and talking about the enlightenment of Islam. So it's not, in my opinion, simply enough to say, well, the Quran has this verse in it or that verse. I mean, you can do the same thing with the Bible. But there are certainly people, even as there are people who use our Bible, the Judeo-Christian, to keep women in a subjugated place, there are certainly people who are still very much using Islam in the same way. The Sharia law, there has been a very strong movement to impose Sharia law in Iraq that would be devastating in its most conservative form, devastating for women's rights. On the other hand, after that resolution passed that would have done that, women organized all over the country. And in a sense, they really exercised their muscle with these organizations, these protests all over, and the governing council reversed itself. It's the only time the council reversed itself.
But is there a sense in Iraq that the time is running out, that unless women make the kinds of strides that you'd like to see them make now, they might not be able to at a future stage? If the political religious complexion of the next government is tilted towards that kind of hardline Islam.
Yeah, one of the things I said to Ambassador Bremer was that he was making decisions that would be affecting tens of millions of women for the next decades. And all he had to do was look next door in Iran to see, you know, we're at a crossroads in Iraq, and the U.S. ought to be leaning full tilt to bring women into decision-making possibilities, because you're right. If they don't, there is possibility for anarchy, for civil war, or for a theocracy that will set women back decades.
Let's take a call from Anthony in Buffalo, New York. Anthony, what did you want to say?
Yes, Julian, thank you. Just a comment and a question. And the comment is looking at any society that suppresses and represses half its population, and here in this case, 60% of the population, is simply not utilizing the potential that that society has. And if we ask the question, you know, why, we can answer, well, attitudes of men and so on. But as I see it, it looks to me as if this is part of a general failure on the part of our own administration in planning, in thinking about what to do following hostilities, in thinking about what to do in the reconstruction phase and so on. So my question is not so much how do we go about getting Iraqis to change, but rather what do we do to raise the issue with the administration and get this administration to understand that this very basic issue that they should have known about and should have looked at, hasn't even been considered.
Swanee Hunt, this is yet another sign of a failure on the part of the people who planned the occupation.
I couldn't agree more. There are some real stars in this administration. Paula Dobrianski is one, the Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs. She has been pushing this issue night and day. I think Colin Powell is a star here. He's been in a very, very tough position throughout this whole Iraq time. But he's up against an extremely powerful Pentagon. And President Bush made it very clear that the Pentagon would hold sway. And this is the result.
Let's take a call from Tom in Dorchester, Massachusetts. And Tom, I understand that you're very much inside track on this particular issue.
Yes, I just got back from Iraq a couple of weeks ago, and I work for the CPA. And I worked with Mandan Hendesi and Salma Weishi and Fern Holland, both of whom were killed on March 9th, working on these issues. And all I can say is we tried to do a lot of things, and we built grassroots women's rights centers in several of the governorates.
When you say we, Tom, you're talking here about the Coalition Provisional Authority,
yes,
are you?
Yes. Yeah. And these issues were actively discussed and promoted as a matter of policy, including the envisioning of some kind of minimum proportion of representation for women on the transitional assembly had it been established, of course, but it was overtaken by events, unfortunately. But we have women's rights centers established in many governorates. These were governed by their own boards. We fitted them out with internet suites, satellite server, internet suites, and all kinds of furniture.
Tom, what you're saying in essence is that the Coalition Provisional Authority is trying as hard as it could to enhance the status of women in Iraqi society.
It was one of the priorities of policy. Ambassador Bremer would go to the opening of each one of these women's rights centers in Karbala, Najaf, Hilla, Diwania, Baghdad. It was a high priority in as a matter of policy.
Swanee Hunt, that seems to be flying in the face of everything you've been saying.
Tom, thank you very much for calling in, and I know several of the people that you spoke of, too. And I remember when I was talking to Ambassador Bremer, he was asking me how he could meet some of the women I was talking about, and he let me know that he was very intent on trying to encourage them. What I'm talking about is the difference in scope. And I don't want to take away, Tom, at all from the work that you did. And I'm very, very glad that you were there. When you compare it to the, 10,000-fold effort and dollars that have gone into a very different approach, that's what I'm talking about.
Tom?
I'm not sure what you're talking about there, but a lot of what we were doing politically was from the grassroots. Leslie Abdella organized a group that went to the CPA and went to the Governing Council and had a demonstration, in fact, at the Governing Council and at local governorates to protest for a minimum representation of 50% in any kind of governmental assembly.
I agree with you. Leslie's terrific. She's a good friend of mine. What I'm saying is that we had less people like Leslie had to come in Act 3 to try to create some kind of correction.
Swanee Hunt, could I just conclude by asking you, just in very general terms, the situation for women, in your opinion, has improved but could be improved that much more?
That's right. And if we can get women into enough decision-making positions, we will see a much more stable Iraq, and we will be able to bring our troops home sooner.
And you see that happening in the coming weeks, in the coming months?
I see a possibility for it, and I also see that we're at a crossroads, and it could go the opposite direction.
Swanee Hunt, many thanks for being with us. Swanee Hunt, founder of the organization Women Waging Peace. She's a lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and a former U.S. ambassador. You've been listening to On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We've been talking tonight about women's status and political representation in Iraq. Continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, reflections of an Olympic torchbearer. This is On Point. With opening ceremonies less than 2 months away, the Olympic flame is making its way across Europe this week. Yesterday, it passed by the headquarters of the European Union in Brussels. Today, it traveled the streets of the Netherlands. After visiting nearly 30 countries on five continents, the torch will make its way to Athens on July the 9th, a month before the start of the Summer Games. Massachusetts resident John Bouters was selected to carry the torch when he came to New York City this past weekend. The 24-year-old law student was given the honor based on the humanitarian work he's done in Africa, South America, and the U.S. In this radio diary, John Bouters says the experience carrying the torch showed him that the Olympic dream is alive and well.
As the bus approached the spot where I would begin my leg of the Olympic torch relay, at the corner of 5th Avenue and East 72nd Street in Manhattan, I peered ahead and saw a crowd of onlookers gathered at the intersection. They were curiously awaiting the arrival of the guy who was to begin the torch's run through Central Park South to its destination in Times Square. My family was there, visiting New York City for the first time from the cornfields of the Midwest, where I grew up. So too were a dozen friends who had come from as far away as San Francisco, screaming to me from the crowd as if I was a movie star, as opposed to the everyday Joe I really am. And then there were a few hundred people I have never met before, but with whom I will forever share a lasting bond. As I got off the bus and ran around the crowd, hugging my friends and family and high-fiving strangers, it finally dawned on me what it meant to carry the Olympic torch. When the torchbearer who would pass the flame to me approached, Central Park filled with a deafening cheer and a sea of American flags rose around me. Traveling the world, the very same flame had been carried across every continent to cities of every cultural, ethnic, religious, social, and political heritage. It had traveled to places wrought with conflict, strife, and hunger, and to places of both peace and prosperity. It had been celebrated and even revered by people from New Delhi to Beijing to Cairo, just as it was being welcomed before me in New York City. I was awestruck. As my torch was lit and cameras flashed from all sides, I realized how significant, yet small, my 400-meter trek was to the purpose of this flame. I smiled, thinking that for a brief moment, 8 billion people had trusted me to carry a symbol that has stood for camaraderie, brotherhood, and peace since ancient times. After finishing my leg, I let children take turns holding the torch and posed for pictures with bicyclists and families that were passing by. It was clear that the Olympic dream was still alive. For a moment, strangers were friends. People shared a joke and helped each other take pictures. There was laughter. As things died down, I left the park, torch in hand. I passed 3 elderly Greek Americans on a park bench. They had heard of the relay passing by, but had missed the event. When I offered to let them hold the torch for a picture, they had tears in their eyes. They would agree only to touch it, insisting instead that I be the one who hold it. "The blessing was given to you," one of the women said. "You must hold it." Indeed, a blessing was given to me. For a brief moment, I became the vessel for a force that in a divided world still helps bring people together through their common human experience. The power wielded by the Olympic torch reminds me of the goals I have pursued in my work and gave me a renewed hope for my dreams of a united world.
John Bouters is a student at Boston College Law School. He lives in Brighton, Massachusetts. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Jane Manners, Tamil Murad, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Michael Garth and Cora Peterson, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point.